Good evening and welcome to the Filson Historical Society. I'm Mark Wetherington, Director, and I want to thank you for joining us for our Filson Institute Public Conference for the spring of 2013 entitled The Roots of Feuding, How Economics, Culture, Political Power, and Media Created an Atmosphere of Feuding in Appalachia. We had a really nice afternoon today during the Feuding in the Cinema segment, and I know some of you joined us for that. Our mission here at the Filson is to collect, preserve, and tell the significant stories of Kentucky and the Ohio Valley history and culture. This is an appropriate topic for us. We have a number of collections that document life and change in Appalachia. If you look in the case exhibits in the back, you'll see some of the David Lucas Feud series paintings on Letcher County, basically, and then some of the books up here are drawn from the collection on feuding as well. So we're well-equipped to support research in feuding and Appalachian studies. Our keynote lecture is presented by Altina Waller, and the title of her keynote is The Social Origins of Appalachian Feuding. Dr. Waller is a professor emerita University of Connecticut. She received her PhD from the University of Massachusetts and has taught at West Virginia University, Rhodes College, the State University of New York at Plattsburgh, and the University of Connecticut. Her book, Feud, Hatfields, McCoys, and Social Change in Appalachia, 1860 to 1900, was an outgrowth of a teaching project at West Virginia University. So without further ado, I'm going to turn the podium over to Dr. Waller, and thank her again for coming here tonight and giving us a keynote that will help us understand what we'll be talking about the rest of our institute.
Well, I'm glad to see you all here. I saw some of you this afternoon to see some of the films. And if you saw the last one, Tolerable David, those evil hat burns from the Tug River Valley, they managed to get into this peaceful town and destroy it. I'd just be interested to see how many of you saw the wildly successful Kevin Costner movie. Quite a few people, yeah. That miniseries, actually, on the History Channel. And it was wildly successful. One of the best 14 million people watched this. And this has revived tourism in the Tug Valley. They're now cleaning up, doing tours, creating parks, reconstructing cabins. So it's become, feuding has now become trendy. So tonight I want to talk a little bit about the context of feuding more than the actual details of who killed who when, because I think that's what Kevin Costner did, and that's what many books, articles, and films about the feud do. This outbreak of feuding that is talked about so much happened mostly in Kentucky. From the 1870s through the 1890s. About a dozen feuds, famous ones that made the national press, not just the local press, but made the New York Times, Chicago Tribune, all over the country. And it made Kentucky famous for feuding. You might say the one feud that I know the most about, that is Hatfields and McCoys, was only half Kentucky because the Hatfields, at least Devil Ants Hatfield, lived in West Virginia across the border from Kentucky, although many Hatfields lived in Kentucky as well. So the question is, for me, when I started doing this, is why is it? Why did all this happen at this particular time? How can we look at this, examine this, and try to figure out what was going on? And is there a bigger explanation than just a few people who were violent and who were abnormal? So I'm going to use the Hatfield-McCoy feud as a kind of example of some of the things I'm talking about. But I think the underlying patterns apply to most of these well-known feuds. Now, What are the usual causes that you usually hear from people when they talk about feuding? Okay, why did they do this? What happened? Well, the first one is always the Civil War. And that is, there was so much violence, and of course, family loyalties were particularly divided in the border states. And even in West Virginia, though it seceded from the Union, from Virginia to become a Union state, loyalties were very divided. So people say that the violence of guerrilla warfare in the region that went with the Civil War was what left the region sort of attuned to violence and ready to engage in violence in unlike other places. In addition, the Civil War, they say, destroyed local governing institutions. And it is true that courthouses were burned and there was fighting. In fact, the Logan County Courthouse, where the Hatfields live, was burned down by Union forces during the Civil War. So records disappeared for that period. So that was true. But the thing that struck me when I started to do the research was how quickly people tried to recover from that, getting back to constructing their local institutions. Their court records returned very quickly. And I don't see, there was in some places there was a lot of violence after the Civil War, but not in particularly in the Tug Valley where this feud took place. Seems to me that they quieted down pretty quickly and really wanted to resume kind of a normal life. Okay, so that's, I don't buy into the Civil War, although I'm sure that the Civil War played partly a role, but I don't buy into it being the cause. Secondly, people say, well, it was the Scotch-Irish heritage, right? These were all folks who came from Scotch-Irish. They were drunk, and they were used to a culture in which they got drunk and fought all the time, chronic warfare. So they just transformed. In fact, they came and settled in Appalachia because it was these mountains where they could carry on this chronic warfare. This was, theory was popularized by a historian named David Hackett Fisher, who was sure that this was the cause. The problem with this theory is that when I did research on the Tug Valley, and this is true for all of Appalachia, the heritage of these folks is about a third English, about a third German, and about a third Scotch-Irish. So it's not a Scotch-Irish culture. It's a blended culture of people meeting and settling in the mountains and blending their culture. So I don't think you can use that cultural argument. Secondly, there's no evidence of unusual violence or feuding until after the Civil War. You don't find this feuding going on before the Civil War. You don't find it being reported or even unusual levels of violence. So that seems to me to say that it wasn't, that isn't a really sufficient explanation. In fact, I'll talk later about the fact that feuding was essentially invented by your own newspaper here, the Louisville Courier-Journal. In the 1880s, in the middle of the 1880s, the Louisville Courier-Journal decided that what was happening in Appalachia was feuding. And before that, no one called it feuding. The participants didn't call it feuding. So, and then the national press picked up on the fact that this must be feuding. Okay, so third explanation is that it was a frontier, lawless culture. These folks were illiterate. They didn't have churches. They didn't have schools. They didn't have courts. It was just the, sort of our image of the Western frontier where there was no law. Well, my research on the Hatfield-McCoy feud was all based on documentary evidence, evidence that appears in court records, court proceedings, land records, deeds, land transactions, tax records. These courthouses are full of this documentation. And to me, that says even though most of these folks were illiterate, they were very careful to write things down. They wanted a written record. They had that heritage from Virginia of written records. judicial proceedings, all kinds of records. So, and also you see evidence, and as we talk about it, you'll see more of it, of courts in operation, churches existing, teachers. Big thing about the budget of these counties was paying teachers. That was really important to them. So that theory about it being just wild with no institutions is wrong. Well, then what's your next question? What am I going to argue, right? What am I going to try help use to try to explain the feud? Well, I'm going to try to persuade you that this conflict emerged from a very severe social and economic crisis in the post-Civil War era in the mountains. And that this social and economic crisis created this climate for competition and for jealousy and for distress. And when people are in that kind of situation, then violence can erupt, and it did in this case. So I'm going to try to use the evidence that I found to convince you that, and you can tell me later if I did the good job. And by social and economic distress and conflict, I mean more than just individuals' conflict with each other about, you know, I want more money than you or I'm trying to cheat you, about a larger picture of the structural changes in the economy that caused this distress. And of course the Civil War plays a role here because there was a lot of destruction. But more than that, even without the Civil War, first of all, there was an agricultural decline. All these folks were farmers. There wasn't very much other kind of business at all, except for the few people who ran a store or something like that, or a preacher. But farming was in decline partly because there wasn't much land, really. It's very steep. If you've ever been to the Tug Valley, that border, it's pretty rugged. And so the farmland is limited. These folks came and settled in the early 19th century, and they had 10, 13, 15 kids. And what that meant in an agricultural society is fathers provided their sons with land. And here they're in a situation where they can't do that. And this is going to create family problems. It's going to create all kinds of problems. So that was the first crisis, and that really doesn't have much to do with the Civil War because that was happening anyway. There was going to be this crisis with not enough land for the increasing population, right? So that's one cause. The second one that's economic, I think, is the coming of industrialization. That is just about the same time that this outbreak of feuds took place, you had the beginnings of the timber industry, big companies coming in to log the mountains. You had coal mining starting, and you had railroad building. This is a pretty dramatic change in a short period of time in this area. So I think these two problems combined, kind of sequentially in a way, to cause real distress. All right, so what's the evidence for this? What's my evidence? All right, the Hatfield-McCoy feud is divided into two parts. Let's look at the first part. First part, let's accept the fact that what people say it started with the trial over a pig in 1878. I mean, some people say it started in the Civil War, but I don't really think that that's the case. But the real beginning was 1878 when there was a trial over the ownership of a pig. And it lasted the first phase until 1882. That's 4 years, right? Only 4 years. But let's look at this hog trial. Now, it's true hogs were important to the economy. That's what some people have argued. It sounds silly to us to have a trial over a pig, but they were important to the economy. But more than that, what was going on here? Well, first thing that happened should make us question the idea that family is at the root of feuding. This is a problem. Old Randall McCoy, and I'll call him Randall, the patriarch, you might say, of the McCoys, went down one day to a stream nearby and saw that Floyd Hatfield, who was... He wasn't Devil Lance. Devil Lance is the leader of the Hatfields, but Floyd was a cousin So it wasn't even a direct accusation, but old Randall accused Floyd Hatfield of stealing his hog. So what did he do? Didn't get out his gun, didn't gather his followers, didn't go shoot people. He went to court. He got the nearest magistrate and said, he's got my hog, let's have a trial. The nearest magistrate happened to be named Hatfield. His name was Preacher. He was a preacher, right? And he was, I believe, a cousin, second cousin of Devil Lance Hatfield across the river. But the McCoys trusted him. He was Hatfield, but they trusted him. Okay. So that's a complication. So then they had the trial. And in the jury, the person who betrayed or voted against Randall McCoy was a guy named Selkirk McCoy. Selkirk McCoy? How did that happen? Well, some people said he was married to a Hatfield. No, he wasn't married to a Hatfield. He didn't have that connection. In fact, he had more. He was more related to the McCoys than he was to the Hatfields, as his name should. So what's this confusion about families? I mean, what's going on here? Hatfields on the McCoy side and McCoys on the Hatfield side. This is one of the first things that grabbed my attention. And if it wasn't family, then what was it? So in order to figure that out, I made a list of all the feudists I could identify the McCoys were pretty easy because there were only 8 or 10 of them, and they were mostly Randall and his children and nephews. But on the Hatfield side, it was a little more complicated. It was maybe a little under 40. So who were they? And why were they backing up Hatfield? And there were some other incidents to get this list. So what I discovered, in short, it was very tedious work to do this, that 45% of them were in some way related to Devil Lance Hatfield. This is true. About 45, under 50%. But 84% of them, the reason they were connected to him was they worked on his timber crew. Lance Hatfield had a timber crew which cut timber and sold it. And most of these feudists who followed him were members of that crew. Either they were his partners, his employees, some way economically connected. So I said, well, that explains why these family connections don't really work. And you also have to remember that in all of this feuding going on, it's a very small percentage of the population. There were many, many Hatfield and McCoy households and families that wanted nothing to do with any of it. So it wasn't like all Hatfield's home. It wasn't at all. It was only a very small percentage. So, in fact, what I found out was of households in the Tug Valley, 95% of them were not involved in the feud. So right away, we're talking about a small percentage. Okay, so this explains some of this Floyd's loyalty. Floyd Hatfield was a member of Hatfield's, his cousin's timber crew. In fact, he was about to move from Kentucky over to West Virginia because he just bought land from Lance Hatfield, so he was really involved. And just before he was about to move is when old Randall accused him of stealing the hog. I don't know if that's a coincidence. But Selkirk McCoy, both he and his two sons worked for Devil Lance. So in the Valley, he was considered a Hatfield, although his name was McCoy. So, but why then? You'd say, well, the timbering crew, okay, so what? Why? Why was the timbering crew sort of the target of this, not quite attack, but animosity? And in order to understand that, you have to understand a little more about what I referred to earlier, and that's the economic crisis in the post-war era with, you know, the land population squeeze, people having, young men especially, having very little access to a future as farmers. And that's what their life was. That's what their status depended upon, having a farm and owning a farm. So the younger generation, sons of people like Devil Lance and old Randall, were very grim. And they had not much hope. So timber seemed to be a way out. When industrializing America needed timber, and West Virginia had it, and Kentucky had it in the mountains, a lot of these farmers tried it. There was a way to recover from the problems of farming. Randall McCoy tried it with his father. His father started cutting. His father had quite a bit of land, and he had his sons, and they cut timber. And at some point, they made a mistake, and they cut timber on somebody else's land. And that person, John Lawson, happened to be one of the wealthy merchants in the county, and he wasn't going to let them get away with that, so he sued them. And as a result of that, Daniel McCoy lost all his land. He became impoverished. And so the experience of Randall McCoy with his father losing the land, none of Daniel's sons, including Randall, got any land from their father because he lost it in this timber suit. The only way that Randall McCoy got any land was he married his cousin Sally McCoy, who got land from her father. So he ended up with a farm in Kentucky, but he didn't get any from his family. Also, as a result of this terrible experience in timbering, Randall's mother sued for divorce because she thought Daniel, his father, was irresponsible. She said he wasn't taking care of his children, and he was foolish, and he knew he was cutting timber on somebody else's land, and he knew it was going to result in disaster, and he kept doing it. So she got a divorce. They'd been married, 30 years or something. So it broke up his family. So you can understand the kind of anxiety about timbering. Well, Devil Ants, on the other hand, was just the opposite, an incredible success story in the timbering industry. He's almost like an American rags-to-riches story until he got nationally famous as a barbarian feudist. But before that, he started out with nothing. His father had quite a bit of land. But of all the sons, Devil Ants didn't get any. Now, we don't know why. I tried to figure out why, but I couldn't get to it. But clearly, it was falling out. So he started with nothing. And he got his land by suing a neighbor because the neighbor apparently, and this is, these court records can be very confusing at times, because apparently the neighbor cut timber on what little land Devil Ants had. So Devil Ants went to court. Again, he didn't shoot anybody. He went to court. And over a long court case, he got 5,000 acres of land, which made him one of the wealthiest people in the Tug Valley. So, and the neighbor, Perry Klein, who I'll tell you about later, had to go off to Pikeville to make his living because he was impoverished. Okay, so after he got the land, he was extremely successful in organizing a crew. He had about 37, 40 people to cut timber. He made contracts with people to sell the land. He was borrowing money, and he was, making all kinds of legal, even though he was illiterate, he was making all kinds of these deals, and he was extremely successful in the timber business. So here were these two individuals who had totally different experiences in the timber industry. And, when I talk to people in Pikeville, sometimes they're annoyed with me because they say I'm on the Hatfield side, And, what I really want people to understand is this is not a personal thing about who's to blame. This is trying to understand the stresses and strains that were going on for everyone in this region at the time and how they reacted. And, it's not to blame. Some people, react differently and they get very distressed. And clearly, Randall McCoy was very distressed about all this. So it's not about deciding who's a bad person or a good person. It's trying to figure out what was going on. Okay, now some little further evidence. The final event of that first phase, which ended in 1882, was the killing of Devil Ants Hatfield's own brother on an election day meeting. Election days were big community gatherings where everyone came and partied, drank, voted. In those days, by the way, and it was viva voce voting, which means you had to announce who you were voting for in public, so everyone knew. But at any rate, these are big events. And three sons of Randall McCoy attacked Ellison Hatfield, who was unarmed. I mean, he was a big man, he was a powerful man, but he was unarmed. And they were drunk, and they attacked him with knives first, and then when he picked up a big rock and tried to fight back, the third brother got a gun and shot him. Now, it didn't kill him right away, but he was mortally wounded. So I tried to imagine that these three boys, and they weren't really kids. I mean, the oldest, Tolbert, was 28, you know, 20s. I tried to imagine them listening to Randall McCoy all these years, their dad saying, oh, you know, those terrible Hatfields and what they've done, and, you know, they got this land illegally. Even though it was legal in court, I'm sure Randall McCoy thought he got it illegally. And so this rage must have just boiled over. But that's my speculation. But the fact is they did attack him. Now, the retribution, and Devlance wasn't there at the time. He wasn't even on the scene. Was a ritualistic execution of these three boys. He took his brother back to the West Virginia side of the river and waited to see if he would live or die. And he announced, if he lives, we'll let the boys go to Pikeville and be tried. But if my brother dies, they die. And he allowed the families to see them. But at any rate, long story short, Ellison died 2 days later. Devlance took the boys, tied them to the famous pawpaw bushes and had them executed in a kind of ritual style. He was thinking he was the court. Now, in a way, he did this. Why would he do this? Because previously, Devlance had always gone to court to get what he wanted. So this is the first time there was extra-legal kind of violence. And that's partly because of the border. The Tug border is between West Virginia and Kentucky. This had happened in Kentucky. The boys would have had to have been taken to Pikeville, which was not part of the community, really. It was across a range of mountains. And Devlance was positive that it wouldn't be justice in Pikeville for him. So it was this sort of arbitrary boundary, which in a way the Tug River binds the community together rather than separates it, because it's shallow, you can get across it easily, much more easily than you can climb the mountains on either side of it. Right? So this was a problem with this arbitrary jurisdiction. But at any rate, the first phase of the feud ended and nothing happened for a while, for 5 years. Now, there were indictments made out in Kentucky to arrest the Hatfields, and the sheriff wrote on the back of the warrants, "They can't be found," which is bizarre, because, of course, they could be found. But I think what happened was most people said, oh, this is terrible. Oh, we're not used to this violence. But it is a rough kind of justice, because think of all the witnesses there'd been at this election and had seen those McCoy boys attack Ellison Hatfield. So I think that for the community, although they were shocked, it was kind of, okay, let's let this go, let's not do anything more. So there was no newspaper coverage. There was a little article in a Virginia paper, maybe like this. That's it. Nobody showed any interest. Louisville Courier-Journal, killings in Appalachian Kentucky, who cares, right? So apparently, it was irrelevant to the press. Now, the second phase happened 5 years later. Now, remember, this is not a feud. Nobody's called it a feud. No press coverage. It's not a feud. Just this conflict. So 5 years later, we have a complete recasting of this feud. And it was mostly... It occurred, most of the events occurred in 1888, although the really final end of it was 1890 when they hanged one of the Hatfield feudists, Ellison Mounts, in Kentucky. But most of the events we know about, the burning of the McCoy cabin, the Battle of Grapevine Creek, were in 1888. So why did it get revived after 5 years? Interesting question. What happened? Well, Perry Klein was now a lawyer in Pikeville. Perry Klein was the individual that had lost his 5,000 acres to Devil Anse back in the court case started in 1872, ended in 1877 when he lost his land. So he was now in a better position. He was a lawyer. He was fairly successful. He also was friends with the governor of Kentucky and actually campaigned for him, is what someone said. So he felt he had a connection, a powerful connection. So what he does is essentially go to the governor and say, let's revive those warrants. Let's get those Hatfields. He called them marauders. They're the worst marauders and desperados you could ever know about. And so a new feud was created, or a new conflict. But this one, I'm arguing, has completely different participants and a different dynamic than the first phase. So we know that Klein had his personal motivation. Let's get back and see if I can get some of my land back. I mean, that seems obvious too. But then you have to say, but why would the governor listen to this? I mean, why would he care? And to bring the whole power of the state of Kentucky to back up personal revenge, it doesn't really make a lot of sense, even if they were friends. So in the 5 years since the end of the first phase and the beginning of the second, what happened to make the governor listen to this argument? Well, during this 5 years, and you have to remember that after 1873, there was a pretty bad depression in the country, the whole country, but it was very bad in Kentucky and West Virginia in the South. So things were not going well economically for the state as a whole. So the Kentucky legislature appointed a commission to investigate the potential for economic development to see if there was coal in the region, in the mountain region. And so the commission investigated, came back with a report to the legislature, says, yes, this is some of the richest coal you're ever going to find. We really should develop this. This is going to save Kentucky's economy, not just the Appalachian region. So suddenly, the mountains become interesting and important where they had not been before. Also, railroads, once they found out about this, the Norfolk and Western was talking about building a railroad. Big economic boost. Land values were going to just soar. They soared just on the rumors of this happening. And finally, probably the governor might have been thinking about all the bad publicity from other violence in Appalachian Kentucky, because there had been other outbreaks, which we now call feuds, but Kentucky was getting a reputation nationally for violence. Now, initially, the Courier-Journal defended these violent outbreaks by saying they were, politics, had to do with politics, they had to do with economic conflict, and, they weren't any different than the North. So in other words, the Courier-Journal saw this as a way to defend the violence outbreaks in Kentucky. But in the middle of the 1880s, the Courier-Journal changed its course entirely and concluded that that violence in Appalachia was irrational, and it was the result of ignorant, backwards people who were doing this, and they needed civilization in the form of railroads. I mean, I'm not even paraphrasing. There's editorials about we need civilization in the form of railroads. So they did this flip-flop, which is pretty amazing, I think, that they just changed their mind, stopped defending Kentucky citizens and decided that Appalachian Kentucky citizens were not defensible, right? And the effect of, and they started calling this feuding. Before, the term feuding had been used to describe a whole variety of duels, of, various kinds of outbreaks in all parts of the region. It was very vague. But in the mid-1880s, the Courier-Journal deciding that feuding was unique to the Appalachians, to the poor, ignorant people of Appalachia. And they were the ones that pervade this definition. And what is the effect of labeling these conflicts, which are over economic issues, what is the effect of labeling them feuding? It's to say that they're ignorant and irrational and trivial, right? It's to dismiss them and to say we don't have to really think about this seriously. So I think you'll hear more about that tomorrow. But I think it's very interesting that they decided on that term. Okay, what was the result of the revival of this feud? There were posses. The governor authorized posses to cross from Kentucky into West Virginia and arrest Hatfields. Official, sponsored by the state of Kentucky. This is where one of the leaders was Bad Frank Phillips, that you hear a lot about. He was one of the people that was appointed to do this. The Hatfields knew about what was going on, and they were frightened at this point. You could tell they were scared to death, but you know, it's the state they're fighting now, not just the McCoys. But they had this notion, at least Devil Anse's children, his sons, had this notion that, well, if you wiped out the McCoys, then the whole thing would go away. And it's not clear what Devil Anse thought about this. He did not go on the raid. And from my reading of what he was like, if he decided to do something, he'd be there. He wouldn't send other people to do it. But at any rate, they attacked the McCoy cabin on New Year's Day of 1888, burned it down. Two of Randall's children were killed. His wife was beaten badly. After that, he moved away from there, moved to Pikeville. But this is what got national attention. This was all over the national press, New York Times, Chicago Tribune, everywhere. This is what made it to a national event. And a lot of the press releases came from Perry Klein. He wrote them. And they went from there to a Catlettsburg paper, to the Louisville Courier-Journal, and then they were reprinted all over the country. So the national attention to the violence, as a result of this, 8 Hatfields were captured and jailed in Pikeville to stand trial. There was almost a pitched battle on Grapevine Creek in West Virginia, which is very ironic because Grapevine Creek is the exact place of the land that was in dispute between Klein and Hatfield. That's where the 5,000 acres was. So the fact that this battle was right there. Not really a battle. Well, Kevin Costner made it into a battle, but it wasn't really a battle. The case went to the Supreme Court the United States Supreme Court, because the Hatfields were essentially captured. They didn't follow extradition proceedings. In other words, the governor of Kentucky did start extradition proceedings to get the Hatfields, but it was the result of these posses that crossed the river and illegally captured the Hatfields that it went to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court ruled in favor of Kentucky. They said, basically, we don't care how they got to Kentucky. They're there. You can try them. And one of the results of this is very interesting. Private detectives, now that there was this bounty on the head of Hatfields, private detectives invaded the region by the dozens. There's all these stories. And they didn't particularly care whether it was a Hatfield or a McCoy or whether they were actually feudists. They're just capturing people. And, you know, when you think about it, you talk about, well, these people in the mountains are very suspicious. Well, they probably got very suspicious after that with people out to capture them. What are the statistics if we look at the second phase of who were the feudists in the second phase of the feud? Were they different? Were they the same? The Hatfield group was pretty much the same. If you had a list of the people that supported Devil Anse in the first phase and the second phase, they'd be almost the same with a few differences. The McCoy side is radically, radically different, right? Less than a third of those who came out in these posses to capture Hatfields were actually involved in the first phase at all, and actually even lived in the Tug Valley. It was a very small number. But two-thirds, most of them, in other words, were from the Pikeville region over the mountains who had nothing to do with all this. So why were they involved? And another difference was the leadership. The leadership of the McCoy side was no longer Randall McCoy, but it was Perry Klein. And Perry Klein, along with, and the people he recruited, that is, other leaders, were the county judge, Tobias Wagner, the senator, Orlando Bowles, a very wealthy merchant named John Dills, the wealthy pillars of the community in Pikeville, joined with Perry Klein to convince the governor to go after the Hatfield group. So the leadership was a very elitist leadership. And the basic demographic difference here about this group, the Klein group, I'll call it the Klein group because it really was. It was no longer the McCoy group. The Hatfields, if you look at their economic situation, they were mostly middling farmers. Now, they weren't wealthy and they weren't poor. They had land and they farmed. That's largely because of Devil Anse's timber operation. They were able to buy land because they'd made profits in timber. The Klein group had very few middling level farmers. They were either these wealthy folks, like Klein now, or they were young men who were poor and landless. And none of them were named McCoy. They were all kinds of people from Pikeville and probably, you know, just out to join the hunt. And probably, you know, it was a big adventure going after Devil Anse Hatfield. There are some other more complicated reasons, which I don't want to go into now. But the point is how different the feud was, what a different conflict it was. In the second phase, it was the power of the state going after these farmers in the Tug Valley, the Hatfields. And it's true the Hatfields got some help from the governor of West Virginia. They did. He was the one that took it to the Supreme Court. The second phase really is local elites who've been trying to bring economic development, that is the railroads and the mines, to the region. And they joined with the state of Kentucky to try to, suppress what they said was violence, although there really wasn't all that much. So calling it a feud erased the mountaineers' very real economic problems and turned them into ignorant, irrational obstructionists to progress. The success for Perry Klein and his allies came when Devil Anse had to sell his land that he'd won from Klein, had to sell it to developers for half its worth. And they bragged about that when Perry Klein was in Louisville. He bragging, well, he sold it for half its worth, so we really did him in. And then Devil Anse had to move away from the Tug Valley, moved his family away. So it's sort of ironic that old Randall, he was about 15 years older than Devil Anse, he began by resisting Devil Anse's, very entrepreneurial, what you might call capitalistic, ambitious timber operation. But he ended up a small part of the group that fostered, was hoping to bring about much more economic development, capitalist development than anything the mountaineers could imagine. I had no idea it was about to come about. On the other hand, another irony, Devil Anse, meanwhile, as I said, was a budding capitalist. He would have liked nothing better to be a part of this developing industrial world. And he was illiterate, but he was smart. And he went about as far as he could before he got involved in what was labeled feuding. But so he was smart, he was ambitious, and he was an entrepreneur. But he ended up being the symbol of the backward, ignorant hillbilly. I just think that's cool. But anyway, final irony, that the feud, the word feud and the Hatfield-McCoy feud came to symbolize violence, a very high level of violence. But what came after that was coal mines and railroads and the coal mine wars, which brought incredibly more violence than there'd ever been in this feud conflict. And the feud conflict was a total of about 12 deaths over 12 years. Nothing like the legend of hundreds of years and hundreds of people. So I don't like to say that. I don't like to say, well, it wasn't very many, but because to the people in the region, it was huge. It was shocking. They weren't used to that kind of violence. But from the point of view of the legend of the hundreds of years and hundreds of people killed, it wasn't very many. So I think that that symbolism is really interesting, that it sort of covers up what came later, which was worse in terms of violence. Okay, thank you very much. And I'd love to have questions. Love to have questions.
What finally brought it to an end?
Well, the Hatfields were tried in Pikeville, and seven were sent to jail, and one, Ellison Mounts, was hanged. And it ended. Nothing happened after that. There were occasions when there were disagreements or fist fights or even shootings when either a McCoy or a Hatfield was involved, and everybody said, oh, it's starting again. They're all going to come out and start. But no. Devilance stayed home. He was happy to stay home, stay out of the limelight. He died in 1921 of old age. Had a big funeral with a big marble statue, Italian marble statue. You can go see it. It's a tourist attraction now. Yes?
The ministry had Civil War loyalties as a factor.
Oh, yeah. Well, some of what they had in the miniseries was fiction. Rael McCoy and Devilance, as far as we know, never served in a unit together, although there's some evidence they served in Devilance's guerrilla unit, the Logan Wildcats, which there's some evidence that Rael McCoy was actually a part of that. Because what's interesting is the Tug Valley itself was pretty much all Confederate sympathizers. Now, the reason people say there's a problem here is Asa Harmon McCoy, who was Randolph's brother, was a Unionist, and he got killed during the Civil War, supposedly by Devilance and the Logan Wildcats. But nobody seemed to worry about it or start any retaliation. It was almost like he was a traitor anyway because he was with the Union side. He served in the Union. There were a lot of Unionists in Pikeville over the mountains, but the Tug Valley itself, as that small community, was almost entirely Confederate sympathies. So it's a more complicated story because, as I said, one of the reasons, what are all these people later who joined the posse in the second phase to go over, a lot of those had been Unionists or came from Unionist families. So I can kind of see that they knew about Devilance and the guerrilla unit, and so maybe they joined up for that reason, but it's certainly not part of the feud that was. So, is that somebody back here? Hi. Well, I think it's very hard to trace from this time to the present because so much has happened with industrialization and changes that it's hard to sort of trace these traits. And I haven't really seen that neuroscience and as being that relevant. In other words, then how do you explain that two-thirds of this population is not Scotch-Irish? But they're all, you know, they have the same cultural. Well, when I went to do research more than 25 years ago, what I learned right away was everyone I tried to talk to in the region didn't know anything. I mean, they said, you know, our parents and grandparents absolutely refused to ever talk about this. To them, it was a shameful event that had been portrayed them in the press as these ignorant country bumpkins. And their parents had just stopped talking about it. And they said, we asked our parents, our grandparents, they won't talk about it. I could not get information on that level. I had to use the documentary evidence because of that. And just telling someone earlier, the few people who sat down to tell me and say, oh, I know something that my grandfather told me, I soon found out that all of those people made the same mistakes that were in a 1948 by Virgil Carrington Jones, which was a very popular book about this feud. But he based it, you know, largely on newspapers, which is a real problem. So, but, and I'm not saying they were lying to me about it. I'm just saying they had, because they didn't know and they didn't have information from their relatives, they had internalized the story that they'd read. And once the book was done, I had so many people in the region, it was really gratifying, saying, thank you for telling us what happened. We never knew. We never knew anything about this, other than it's famous and it makes us look bad. Yes?
Speaking of newspapers, what do you attribute the sudden change in the Courier Journal's articles? Is it the editorship, the editor?
No, it was all Henry Watterson. It was all Henry Watterson. No, I think it was the pressure of wanting to support development, economic development in that region. And to their eyes, to the merchants and folks who lived in Louisville, people who resist that, resist progress, got to be ignorant and backward, right? So I think that that's what did it when that real possibility of industrialization appeared and railroads, that they started, well, you know, there, because a lot of this violence that they then called feuding was actually resistance to the building of railroads and so forth. So I think that's, who knows completely, but it seems to me that's a lot of it.
What kind of time period were we talking about? 5 years, 6 years?
In about 3 years, they did a flip-flop.
Okay.
Yeah, it was amazing. I was shocked. After I did the book, I did another article about the evolution of the feuding stereotype. And I read the Courier Journal and the New York Times carefully in microfilm for years to trace this. And I was amazed that it changed so quickly. Absolutely amazed.
All about expressway.
Yeah. Yes.
I remember seeing a couple of movies, Mom, Bob Kettle.
Oh, yeah.
But the thing is, in those movies, it was the Eastern Jews who looked foolish, and Mom,
yes.
Kettle, very,
right.
Very wise.
Yes. There is this romantic side to Appalachians, right? And that was mostly the view before this feuding broke out. The writers who reported on Appalachia were mostly reporting, well, they're a little backward, but they're quaint. You know, they're simple. They lead a simple life, and isn't that nice to have a simple life? But it was with this, the prospect of industrialization and resistance to it and violence that they suddenly became barbaric. A New York reporter went to the feud region and wrote a book, T.C. Crawford's book, An American Vendetta, A Story of Barbarism in the United States. And that became the symbol of it. He called it Darkest Africa. Hmm. Yeah. But that was a real change from the previous portrayal of these folks as, you know, kind of quaint, admirable people. And there's been a recent article about that the two stereotypes actually continue to exist side by side, because there's still that sort of romantic view of quilts and, you know, pottery and things like that. But it was these violent outbreaks that really took over as the predominant view of Appalachia. But when you think of the Beverly Hillbillies, for example, I mean, their down-to-earth wisdom is better than the more sophisticated. So that endures. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Did T.C. Crawford spend a lot of time with Pierce Klein?
Did who?
T.C. Crawford spent a lot of time with Klein.
He did. He met everybody. He actually, but he would. Yeah, he was the only. Other reporters went to the region, and they did spend all their time with Rail McCoy and Perry Klein. And Crawford was really the only one who actually visited Devil Anse in his home. So,
when Devil Anse moved away, where did he go?
He just moved back to near Logan. I mean, he didn't go to California or anything. He just moved back to near Logan, where he was away from the Tug Valley. And he was kind of considered a respected kind of quaint old guy for years. Going to town, the newspaper report, well, Devil Anse was in town today. And there's a lot of argument about how he got the name Devil. And nobody, we don't know. There's no way to know. I mean, there's all kinds of stories, like his mother, you know, he was fighting a catamount when he was a boy, and she said, oh, well, the devil couldn't scare him or something like that, and he became the devil. And then the Civil War, he was such a fighter in the Civil War and defended a place called the Devil's Backbone, so he got to be called the devil. Maybe it was the feud. But he said, he once said, well, somebody asked him about religion before he got converted later in life. He was converted when he was an elderly man. But before that, he was never interested in religion. And he said, well, if there's any church I belong to, you could say it was the devil's church. And his family uproariously laughed when he said that. Yes?
What becomes of Randall McCoy and his economic fortunes?
Well, they never get any better. He moves to Pikeville, actually, and lives with Perry Klein. And Klein gets him a job running the ferry across the river in Pikeville. And he's always, but he never recovers in terms of, economically recovers. And he never got over it. He kind of, his reputation until he died was going around just talking to people about how we have to get those Hatfields, you know, what they did to him. So, and he died in a fire. I forget the date for that. Yeah. And it's interesting because when Devil Anse died, they built him, had a huge funeral of thousands, you know, hundreds of people, and had Italian marble imported and built this life-size statue. And when Randall McCoy died, he was buried in the John Dill Cemetery with an almost unmarked grave. It's very hard. Now you can find it because they put it up again, but it just shows the difference in economic levels. And you just have to get over the Hatfield-McCoy feud. I mean, it's the first part was Hatfield-McCoy. Second part was Hatfield-Klein. It wouldn't have happened without Klein. Second part would not have happened without Klein. Yes. Yes.
Just following up on a side comment, could you suggest a source on the coal mine waters?
Oh, gosh. I think John Hennin here probably knows more about that than I do.
On the coal mine waters themselves, the most recent one is by a guy named Robert Shogan. It's on, I forget the name of it.
That's Battle Blair Mountain.
Yeah, it was on Blair Mountain. S-H-O-G-A-N. I still think the best one is David Corman's book.
Oh, really? I love that one. Yeah, that's a good one.
1981, I think it's called Life, Work, and Rebellion in the Coal Mine.
Yes, that's a good one.
Who is the author?
David Corman.
Corman, yeah.
C-O-R-B-I-N.
Dr. Waller, thank you very much.
You're very welcome.